everyone, and welcome back to another as yet unknown numbered episode of the Zoology Ramblings podcast, because we cannot be bothered to go back and see how many we've officially done, because we're both very, very busy. But anyway, we're back with me, Roby Watkinson, down in Cape Town, and...
Hello, it's me, Emma, and I'm in Bristol, very less exotic than Cape Town, but... You know.
No, but I was doing it like, you know, people can understand where we are and stuff, and it's, you know, it's nice to get the spatial arrangement of the presenters.
I feel like we've done a lot of different episodes where we're in completely different places. I feel like we only had that very narrow window where we were actually in the same place, but mostly we are halfway across the world.
Yeah, looking back, we should have really made more of an effort to record them when we were in the same
house. I love that we didn't do them when we were living in the same house, that we didn't record.
We were very busy. We were finishing undergrad, to be fair. But yeah, hello everyone in the world of the internet. I never know what to do for these introductions. I'm just like, hello, internet people. We hope you're all well. As ever, we are going to completely randomly change up our... schedule of what we're going to talk about. We're going to do a little update of what Emma and I have been getting up to in the world of zoology and conservation. And then Emma had a lovely idea. Do you want to tell them about your little idea to replace our species of the week? Just because we've been very busy and we haven't been looking at many different species. So we're going to do a new thing which Emma's come up with.
Yeah, we thought we'd just do like a moment in nature of the week, just something that we've noticed or enjoyed in nature from this past week. And I think it's something that we encourage you all to do as well. I think it's a nice way to go out and notice nature, even if it's something like, it was a nice sunrise, that counts. Just something to notice, notice the world around you. I quite like that. And then we're going to end with news, is that right?
We are going to end with the news, yes. I mean, I've got quite a bit of news from the world of conservation biology, and I know Emma as well has some very strong thoughts and opinions coming up, which I share. But yeah, would you like to begin, Emma, with your update on what you're doing in the world of conservation and zoology and what you've been up to since we last spoke?
Yes, that sounds good. This will be a very big update because I'm aware I've been in post for like over 6 months now, and I don't think we've done a podcast since I properly started my job.
No, I don't think so. If we have, apologies, everyone.
I don't think we have. If so, it would have been very brief of kind of what my role was in the first couple of weeks. Mm. And obviously it's developed quite a lot since then. Which is exciting. So we're now full blown down the rabbit hole of the Wildlife Champions program, which is what I'm working on at Avon Wildlife Trust. And it's awesome. I love my job. I love the champions. They inspire and motivate me every day. And yeah, it's just amazing. And I can't believe I get paid to do it.
So do you want to just maybe tell the world who the Wildlife Champions are, what they do, and what your job is?
Let's see if I can sum that up concisely. So I am the Wildlife Champions. This is a test. Whenever I try and tell people, they're like, huh, it sounds cool, but I don't really understand your job. So here we go. So I'm the Wildlife Champions Assistant, so I am supporting a group of wildlife champions from all across Avon, which for those of you outside of the UK is a county in the UK that covers a lot of different postcode areas. and wildlife champions are anyone who has a passion for nature and their community, who kind of want to spread that passion for taking action for nature in kind of whatever way it looks like to them, to be honest, and spread that to the community to inspire other people to take action as well. So at the moment, as of today actually, we have 19 wildlife champions from 10 different postcode areas, and they're all working on such amazing community projects. So you've got some who are doing community vegetable growing, some who are doing big wildlife corridor networks across Bristol, which is exciting.
Nice.
Recycling projects. I mean, there's so much. And they're just, all starting to share ideas.
That's so
they're sending
cool.
each other seeds in the post. It's just beautiful.
And is the Wildlife Champion something that all the wildlife trusts are doing, or is it just an Avon Wildlife Trust thing?
I think there's about five other trusts that have similar projects. None exactly the same. Mm-hmm. It's not kind of a trust-wide thing. But there definitely are some that are doing similar things, and I've had chats with them about what have you found has worked well, what hasn't worked well, so that can kind of inform how our project runs, and that's been really helpful. So yeah, particularly I think the Scottish Wildlife Trust have a very, very impressive program. I think it's called something like the Pioneers program or something like that.
Ooh, and Pioneers so program. I like that.
Similarly, they kind of upskill people in this 6-month project, and then they go off into the world of feeling like they're able to run their projects themselves and be all inspired. So that's what we're hoping for. Early days, but it's going well so far.
That's so cool. That's so cool. I know you're enjoying it.
I really, really love it. It's full on. It's, quite a lot of work to manage all the champions. The only thing I'm finding is I'm missing the wildlife side of things. But I knew that this was going to be a more of a people-y job, and I love the people side of things. But you know me and Roby, we love a bit of rewilding. We love going off looking at poo tracks and otherwise, and I'm definitely missing the poo tracks and otherwise. Other than that,
well,
yes,
happily
I love it.
Enough, Emma is going to be visiting me in Cape Town shortly, and I will take you out and we can go and looking for some poo tracks and otherwise.
Oh my goodness,
I know a good
yes.
spot for caracals and porcupines I can show you.
That will be a very, very good fix of that niche side of my personality that I need to fill sometimes.
Speaking of niche sides of the personality, I got recognised through Zoology Ramblings the other week.
You said that. I can't believe we've reached the world of Cape Town.
I know. It was really weird. I was sitting having my lunch, and another student, an undergrad, came up to me and said, are you Roby? And I said, yes. How do you know who I am? And she said, I listen to Zoology Ramblings. And I was like, oh my God, this is the weirdest thing ever.
Can I just ask, how did they know it was you? Because we're faceless on Zoology Ramblings.
Yeah, but I think because we also talk about our Instagrams and Zoology Ramblings.
Okay. Yes, that's probably where they found us.
Yeah, I mean, they said they really liked the podcast, so well done us. And I imagine if they listen to this episode, shout out to you. I cannot remember your name. You did tell me. But that was fun.
But yeah, it's such a lovely little global community that we've managed to reach in some way or another about rambling about conservation topics. So as ever, thank you for listening, listeners around the world. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's really cool. I really like that we're building a little bit of a, I wouldn't call it a community because no one knows each other, but I like that people from other places can listen to us and find some meaning and find some joy in it, because that's sort of really what it's all about. So shall I do my little update of what I'm up to?
Please do. I assume you have more tracks, poo, and otherwise than I do.
I actually have so much tracks, poo, and otherwise. Actually, not so much poo. I'm not really doing poo, but I am doing tracks. So, I think I've mentioned on here before that I'm doing a master's in conservation biology down at the University of Cape Town, which is oodles of fun, as you can imagine. But we've just kind of finished the coursework component of our master's. And so now we're starting on the project. So I thought I'd give you an overview of the project. I may have done this before on here, but hey, if you're a first-time listener or you haven't listened to the previous ones, here you go again. It'll be really, really brief. This is a test of how well I can summarise what I'm doing. So I'm working on leopards in Namibia. And the aim of the game is to compare different methods for estimating leopard density. Density is the sort of most important metric that we look for in cat conservation, especially. It's more useful than occupancy, and it's more useful than absolute number, because what density does is it locates individuals in space and time, and that gives you a much more broad scale, a much more applicable figure to work with, essentially, produces these lovely heat maps of things across the landscape. And so obviously that's really, really useful, but it's also bloody hard to figure out, because as I said, you need to combine number with space, GPS, and a timestamp. And leopards being basically ninjas in like an open system like Kruger or the Serengeti or Luangwa, where we've always been, like your odds of getting a leopard population count are nothing. Like you're just guessing. And so the only way we can really test and compare different methods to estimate density is if we have a known population. And the only way we can get a known population is if you work on an enclosed reserve. Now, even an enclosed reserve has, you know, I mean, my supervisor says that if water can get through a fence, a leopard can get through it. Like, you're never going to keep leopards in or out. So this assumption of population closure in both space and time, which is a really important factor in the density model, we sort of work around that by just like sampling in like a 45-day period to sort of hope that no one migrates in or out and dies and stuff like that.
So are you going to be doing, or are you doing your research in an enclosed area? Is that where you're starting?
Yes. Yes, we're working on an enclosed reserve in Namibia. We're going to be sampling over a 45-day time period to hopefully not violate this assumption of spatial and temporal closure. And we're testing four different methods for estimating density. The first method is VHF collaring. And it's probably the most simple method. You just go out, tranquilize every leopard you see, put a collar on it, follow it, boom, you know how many leopards there are. But, you know, this method is incredibly expensive. You need a vet on hand. There's incredible, really, really high welfare risks. Like leopards just kill themselves. Like because they're especially with the males, the necks grow as they age. So if you put a collar on it, they just strangle themselves to death. So it's a really awful thing to do if you don't need to. The other method is a camera trap array, just like a standard double camera array. So you can photograph both sides of the individual, unique coat patterns, you can get an ID. And then there's a baited camera trap array, so sticking donkey heads up a tree, same idea. this one also has some interesting things. It probably biases towards, you know, dominant adult individuals, probably biases towards males over females. But probably you get a better detection of dependent cubs as opposed to like a normal camera trap survey. And then the final method is a spoor survey or a footprint survey.
Oh, you were telling me about this the other day. This is so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. This is what I'm almost most excited about. So the typical way of doing a footprint survey, or spoor as it's known, is to drive along the road network in a reserve with either a highly skilled field guide sitting on the front of the car, or a highly skilled member of the San community, a tribe who sort of live, a tribal community who live in northern Botswana, Namibia, and some bits of northern South Africa as well. And they've got this incredible indigenous knowledge that they can actually ID an individual leopard based on its footprint alone. And that
imagine
gives you
having that knowledge.
Incredible.
Seems like such an integral piece of knowledge that has been lost, not just obviously for leopard footprints, but that ability to know what you're looking at and what's in the landscape. I feel like most people nowadays in modern society don't have anything close to that, and that's a shame.
And even, yeah, it's an incredible connection to nature that we've lost. And even in the San community, this knowledge is held by like a handful of elders. And there are programs to try and retain this knowledge and pass it down. But anyway, for the purpose of my master's, I'm a little short on both highly qualified field guides and San trackers, not having any to hand. So what I'm going to do instead, I'm using a new method. It's essentially trying to digitize that skill. And it's called WildTrack. And it's a technique called the footprint identification technique. So the gist of it is you go to, say you're doing white rhinos, which has been done before. You go to a load of zoos, you get the footprints of a load of individual white rhinos, and you essentially teach a computer algorithm to to match the variation in footprints to individuals. So you build up this database of this algorithm with as many different captive white rhinos as possible, so the algorithm knows what a white rhino footprint looks like.
Sorry, is that through pictures or kind of like actual, you need yes. like prints? Just phone, like phone pictures?
No, footprints. Yeah, yeah. You take a photo. Yeah, yeah. Okay. You can do it on your phone, you can do it with a camera. And you use, you know, morphometric markers on each print to teach the algorithm. And then once you've got that algorithm, once the algorithm knows what a white rhino footprint looks like, and hopefully you've got enough captive individuals to encapsulate variation in the population, you can go into the wild. And you can go, every time you come across a footprint, you take a photo, and the app or the algorithm will say, this individual is distinct from the last one you showed me. So again, you get number in space and time, so you can do density. And
that
this is the
so
least
cool.
invasive method. Yeah, it's really, really fun. And it's been tried and published successfully with black and white rhinos, jaguars, cheetahs, pandas, tapirs, polar bears, Amur tigers. Guess what it hasn't been done with?
Ha, leopards.
Yeah. So part of my work is I'm gonna try and do this with leopards and publish it, hopefully. But part of what I need to do before that is build up a database of captive individuals' footprints. So there's about 10 in the database already, which Wildtrak have already collected. And I'm going to pick up this week, actually. I'm going to go to a rehabilitation sanctuary in Pal and get the footprints of two captive leopards there, which will involve laying down some sand and then getting a little bit of meat on a stick and going, puss, 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 and hoping it walks along so I can take photos of its footprints.
That is insane. Can I just say your day-to-day looks very different to mine, but I love that we're both on happy career paths in different ways, but I'm definitely not going out and taking pictures of leopard footprints.
Well, don't get me wrong, my day-to-day is mainly sitting in front of my laptop, you know, devouring papers and trying to get this algorithm up and running with these partners I'm working with. But yeah, that's sort of what I'm up to. And then the field work to go up and test it in the field, in the reserve I'm working at, is in November. So that's exciting. Gives me some time to prepare.
That is so exciting. I think we'll definitely have to do a ramblings to let people know when you've come back from that.
And, yeah.
I mean, what an incredible experience to get out there in Namibia and do that.
Should be good fun. I mean, it's deeply stressful, as all field work is, but it should be good fun. And actually, I wonder if this is something our listeners can help with. So obviously, you know, we've got enough leopards in the database to make the algorithm run effectively. But adding individuals to that database is only ever a benefit. So if anyone listening, you know, works at a zoo or has any connections to a zoo or knows of any zoos which have leopards, they've got to be African leopards, not Amur leopards, not any of the Asian ones, and, you know, thinks they might be willing to be able to get me some footprint photos, do let me know and reach out over Instagram. It would be greatly appreciated. And I will, of course, say a little thank you in the acknowledgement section of my paper.
I reckon, you know what, in this strange community that we've created through Zoology Ramblings, I reckon there's someone out there who would be working in a zoo and could help you with that.
I hope so. I mean, even if nothing comes of it, we've got enough. But that would be quite fun. That would be a nice little thing to do. So yeah, that's my update. Do you want to do your wild moment?
Oh yes. I guess my wild moment relates to my news.
Ooh.
And I guess, it's not necessarily what you'd consider wild, but it felt very important and optimistic and empowering. So the other day, my colleagues and I from Avon Wildlife Trust were rallying outside the DEFRA office in Bristol, in response to the State of Nature report, which came out, which I'm going to talk about a little bit more. And it was so hopeful. I mean, there weren't that many people there. That wasn't the point of this rally. It was more to have key partners there, like the Wildlife Trusts, like RSPB, people like that, where you show your face to show that, you're there and you're making an impact and you're taking a stand. And I think particularly because the Wildlife Trust had made the decision not to go to events like the big one, It mm-hmm. was really nice to be able to be there with my colleagues. The CEO was there. We were chatting to people, and the overwhelming comment was, thanks for being here. It's really nice to see the Wildlife Trust here at an event like this. And it was just That's there with so megaphones nice. Going like, what do we want? Action for nature. When do we want it? Now. And so, yeah, all those kind of hopeful chants. the idea wasn't to preach doom and gloom. It was to show how important it is that we do protect nature and that we protect it now. So, yeah, felt very empowered after that.
Did you get any engagement back from DEFRA? Did they come out and talk to you, or...?
I need to check what actually happened, because I was on the other side of the road and someone came out and I think said they weren't allowed to take this letter. So Chris, the event was organised by Chris Packham, and he'd written a letter to DEFRA, which was a beautifully written letter. It's available online, kind of demanding a bit more of the body that is the main organisational body, I guess, that can make environmental decisions here in the UK.
Yeah.
And I don't think they took it. I think someone came down and did engage and was chatting, but they said that they couldn't take it. So I guess, not as hopeful.
Why couldn't they take it?
I don't know. I honestly don't know, because it was a very well-written letter by a renowned kind of conservationist and activist who would have said it in a way that wasn't demeaning or wasn't pointing any fingers, just kind of a highlighting we need action. So I'm not entirely sure. The bigger rally was in London. That's where Chris Packham was. I'm yet to hear if anything came out of the London one. But it's a shame there wasn't more engagement from DEFRA.
Yeah. But quite heartwarming that so many stakeholders came together, hey?
It was really lovely. It was lovely that we could be there. It meant a lot to me, because in my personal life, I do a lot of activism and campaigning. But to be able to go with...
Yeah.
Okay, you'll like this, Roby. So I went to the rally with a felted stuffed badger head around my neck.
Oh, dear. Oh, if only it was a beaver.
I know. Sadly, the charity shop didn't have felted stuffed beavers. Otherwise, I'd be wearing it every day. But yes, that was my kind of nature empowering moment. What was yours been, Roby?
Well, mine was much less, making change on a big scale. And mine was much more on a sort of a personal level. So I took two really good friends, one of whom I hadn't seen in ages, up for a hike up Table Mountain, up a pretty intense gorge called Skeleton Gorge, which is always quite fun. And we got to the top and we found a little stream and we went frogging.
Frogging?
Yeah, we went looking for frogs. And we had a little book, which is a guide to frogs and frogging in South Africa. And we sat on a little bridge overlooking a little stream on the top of Table Mountain, trying to ID these little frogs we were seeing. And it was a really gorgeous moment of being out in nature and appreciating the little things with two really good friends. And I realised I hadn't done that for a long time. And it really reconnected me a little bit. And took my mind off a lot of stress that was going on and stuff. And it made me very, very thankful for the opportunities that we have and also for the nature that we still do have left.
No, that sounds wonderful. I'm chuckling because in my head, I don't know why my head imagined this, but because you said frogging, I just assume like you were all jumping around like pretending to be frogs. But then I'm like, no, that it makes a lot more sense that you were actually looking for frogs.
We were indeed looking for frogs, yes. Yeah. Well, now that we've done our update and our wild moment, shall we have a little break for all of our listeners? I was about to say readers, but no, I mean listeners. Have a cup of tea, get a biscuit, whatever it is people want to do. Because now we're going to talk about the news, and I suspect the news might be a little bit longer. And I know you and I feel quite strongly about the news this week.
Yes.
And so it might be a little bit more, serious conservation stuff. So take 5 minutes and we will see you in a bit.
See you after the break.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so hello everyone. I realise I just leant very close to the microphone, so if that okay came out as a deafening roar, then I apologise. But we are ready to do the news section. Well, I say we're ready. Emma's doing what looks like handstands. I can see through the corner of my Zoom call.
Stretching is important, Rofi.
It is. Emma, would you like to begin with your news?
Yes, I'm going to try and refrain from too many strongly phrased words and opinions and say this as diplomatically as possible. Yes.
But we can swear. We can swear on Zoology Ramblings, remember? So if you feel the need, if you really want to underline your strength of feeling, I mean, I will swear, you know.
I probably will, but I do want to try and convey it as kind of factually as possible, I guess. So this builds on from my moment in nature that I shared, and it's about the... No, you know, I'm going to let rip. It's about the very poor decisions by the UK government that were made in the kind of time scale of 24 hours. So there was a lot of...
I love how your version of letting rip is saying it's very poor.
No, look, I'm gonna shit on the government. So just before I say any more, I want to clarify that what I'm about to say, these are my own personal views. These aren't the views of Avon Wildlife Trust, who I work for, but these are my personal views, disconnected from my line of work. I can't remember what day it was. It was probably about a week ago now that the State of Nature report came out. And also the same day that the UK decided to approve the largest undeveloped oil field in the UK, Rosebank, and it got given the go-ahead. Woohoo! On the same day as the release of the State of Nature report. So, yes, lots of anger. Yeah, I was fuming, and some of you might have seen I went on a little rant on Instagram, and it took me so long to say that. I mean, I recorded like 40-something videos before I managed to get one that I was happy with, because it was just frustration and I kept stopping and not knowing how to say it. I think because it was, yeah, I didn't know how to put it into words.
Yeah. Well, can I say for the record, if anyone hasn't listened to Emma's little diatribe on Instagram, it is, as always, as everything that Emma produces, it is... an exceptional thing to listen to, and I think you really should listen to it. And I thought you dealt with it really powerfully and really really respectfully, actually. I thought so. Anyway, that's just my two cents.
Oh, thank you. No, I appreciate that. So if you have listened to that, some of this might be quite similar, but I'll do a little summary of what happened. So I'll start with the State of Nature report. So this is a report that is kind of led by the RSPB, but there's about 60 other partners involved in writing it, collecting the data. A lot of the data is collected by volunteers, and I really appreciate that they really credit that in the report. They recognise that most of the data is possible because of volunteer work, and that's not celebrated enough. And what this report does is it amalgamates about 50 years worth of data about kind of the abundance, the distribution and extinction risk of different species and habitats in the UK. And they break it down by regions in the UK. So there's a separate report for Wales and England and Scotland and Ireland. And then they have one that fuses it all together. Mm-hmm. And the last report was in 2019, I think. And so this is the 2023 one that's just come out. And it's not looking good. There isn't really a nicer way of saying that.
Surprise.
I mean, I don't... Have you read the full report, Roby? I haven't. I've read the summary version because the full report's like 200 pages.
Yeah, I will. I actually will read the full report. I haven't read it yet. Like you, I've read the summary because I've been, you know, up to my elbows in leopard footprints recently. But I will read it, and I quite strongly actually will read it. I feel a bit disconnected from what goes on back home, being, you know, in all the way on the other side of the planet. So I will read it. I will. I just haven't got around to it yet.
I think, yeah, I'll try to as well. I mean, the summary has some great graphics in it and explains kind of key measures of what they were looking for and what they found. But they did kind of collect data, I think it was on thousands of species. And I mean, some shocking figures, I guess, to draw out from the report is that one in six species are at risk of being lost from Great Britain. So that's about 1,500 species that are at risk of extinction. And I think that's about 16% of all overall terrestrial species are threatened with extinction. So that's the same figure in a few different formats, but equally shocking.
Yeah, just repackaged. Yeah, blimey.
And what else did they find? They highlighted how our wildlife has declined by about 19% since the 1970s. And we've said this on so many podcasts. I think a lot of people in the conservation world knew this already, but outlining that the UK is one of the most nature-depleted countries on Earth. I think it's in the bottom 10% of countries was what this report said.
Can I say my thing? Can I say my rhyme? Depauperate, degraded and denuded.
Can we please get that on a t-shirt?
It's true. Our national parks are farms. Our oceans are deprived of fish. Our rivers are dry. Well, they're not dry, they're flooding because we haven't got enough beavers. Although, actually, no, beavers are doing quite well. Anyway, complete us diatribe. Sorry, continue.
No, that sums it up, really. So, yeah, kind of building on from your point, you kind of mentioned about intensive farming and exploitation of oceans and things like that. Another thing that came out of the report was that only 11% of UK land is protected. And the rest of it, frankly, isn't managed brilliantly. But when we're considering massive rewilding projects and needing to bring species back like beavers, like lynx, like wolves, which, you know, check out our other podcast if you haven't heard us talk about that before.
There's a whole litany of stuff we've done on that.
Yeah, it's very hard to do when we're looking at about 10% of land being protected. That's 90% of land that's probably farms.
Yeah. And also it's about quality as well, not just quantity, in that obviously, you know, Britain is a relatively small country. We have a high urban population, and that's totally fine. And all of those people need to eat. So we do need lots of agricultural land, and that's totally fine. But the bits that remain are not managed well. They're not connected. They're not managed with these ideas of cause, corridors, connectivity, you know, pattern and process. It's just outrageous.
Yeah. And I think a big thing that was highlighted and also needs to change is the way that farming can coexist with wildlife. They don't have to be two completely separate things. But yeah, I can't remember the figure from the report, but it was saying how few farms are actually in line with kind of being environmentally or wildlife friendly. That it's just a really, really small figure of farms that are actually able to engage with them. Yeah, with making their farms slightly less intensive and more friendly for wildlife.
Yeah, and the trouble is, when we're talking about these criticisms, please don't think that we're criticizing, you know, the process without an understanding of how the process works. When it comes to, you know, conservation policy on a national scale, you know, organisations like the Wildlife Trusts, I was about to say Cape Nature, but no, that's down here. Organisations like the Wildlife Trusts and the National Trust and these things, they can have influence, but they need to be guided by a national framework. And so we need to see a government and an environment ministry that is receptive to these scientific ideas, and that it will listen to the experts, and that will drive policy in that way to enable these partner organisations like the Wildlife Trusts to actually do the work that they can do and they want to do. So this is a real, you know, at the risk of getting political, sod it, I'm too late now. This is a political damnation as well as an ecological one, I would argue. And what I think this, you know, the state we have at the moment fails to realise that we will not achieve net zero and reverse Britain's particular biodiversity crisis by maintaining the current situation, by conserving the current situation. We need to restore, we need to rewild, we need to regenerate, and the lack of government action on this is a fundamental either misunderstanding of what's needed or just a refusal to see it.
I think both. I think it's, yeah, refusal yeah, to see it and complete ignorance and walking around with blindfolds on. But I think I really respect you kind of putting it the way you just did. And that is kind of what the rally was all about that I was at. It's kind of mobilizing DEFRA, the government body, to say, look, we can't just keep going as normal. It's you who has to put the legislation in place to make it possible for people like the Wildlife Trust to do the work. And it is possible. And as a flip side, that was a brilliant thing that came out for the State of Nature report, was that it said that because of these kinds of reports, we know more now than we ever did about the state of nature in the UK. We know really well what the baseline is and what we need to do. We know where we need to target efforts.
Love a baseline.
We know where we need to put conservation practices in place for it to work.
And because conservation practices have to come from both the top and the bottom, like, you are working at a local scale and you're having such an impact coming up from the bottom and doing these community-based conservationists, but you need to be empowered in your work by the state, which sets a policy framework that enables you to get the most work done. So I can only imagine how frustrating it must be for you, you know, boots on the ground at the coalface of British conservation, to see the state failing you in this regard. I would very quickly just like to touch on Rosebank very quickly. I mean, I'm not gonna go into why Rosebank is bad, because I think we're all pretty, we can all put two and two together why opening up another oil and gas field is bad. But I thought I'd address some of the comments that are going around about why people are justifying it. So I'm seeing a lot of comments saying, oh, you know, it's worth it because it'll bring a lot of money into the UK. And actually, what I'd like to point out is that the majority shareholder in Rosebank is a Norwegian company. So the profits won't come to the UK. The profits will go offshore. So the oil won't be sold in the UK. It will be sold internationally. And the government has said this. It's going to be sold to international prices. So it won't change UK energy prices. Also, oil and gas both no longer employ that many people because we've got so good at automating the industry. So it won't employ that many Brits. It will have vast carbon emissions. And it won't achieve net zero, even if the government offset it elsewhere. And even though they said they are going to try and offset the emissions of Rosebank, offsetting the problems from the UK to tropical regions with higher biodiversity isn't going to solve the problem of net zero. It's just, it's not true. It's just shifting the problem from where we can deal with emissions pretty well to areas where people cannot deal with emissions pretty well. And, you know, there's a lot of discourse saying that Rosebank is going to benefit the British people by lowering energy prices. This is not true. You know, it's said it will reduce reliance on foreign energy. Possibly, but not routinely. Only in emergencies is the clause there. It will grow the UK economy? No. The profits are going to go offshore. It will create jobs? No. Not really many. Certainly not as many as the growing green economy would. And so these are falsehoods that are being peddled. And they're either being peddled with the intent to deceive or through ignorance and misinformation. And frankly, I don't think either are worthy of a democratically elected government. Anyway, that's my diatribe over.
No, I think it's really good to myth bust some of those things, because I've been delving into the other side, you know, which is always dangerous, reading some newspapers that I would never in hell read normally, like the Daily Mail. And just to kind of see some of those points that are being made, and kind of why is it that people say this is a justifiable idea, because as someone in the conservation sector and as someone who cares about, you know, the future of existence of all life on Earth, you know, no big deal, I can't tell, like, why there'd be any logic to open up a new oil field. It's just not something that... It's not in anyone's radar.
It's funny, I think we can tell why there's logic in opening up a new oil field, because I think the people who run the country are financially entangled and invested, and the fossil fuel industry is very powerful, and it gives donations, if you can't see me, I'm making parentheses, to politicians. And I just think this really, really shows that this is not a, the green agenda, let's call it, is not a priority for this government. And I'm saying this not to draw a partisan line across the issue, because this affects everyone. No matter which side of the political aisle you're on, we're going to be on the same physical aisle in 20 years' time when we can't breathe the air, which we already know is crap, and when the sea levels are rising. And so, you know, our great power in a democratic country is our democratic process. So if you even half agree with whatever we've said, you can make that felt. You need to elect representatives of parties that take the environmental crisis seriously.
Talking of which, there was a very powerful quote from leader of the Green Party, Caroline Lucas, and she said that Rosebank was the greatest act of environmental vandalism in her lifetime. So this is causing some very Blimey. Strong opinions from people in power who recognise that we don't have the luxury of time to make decisions like this, because to put it into scale of emissions, which I think they did this for the shock factor, is that the carbon dioxide emissions that will be produced from Rosebank are going to be more than the world's poorest 28 countries produce in an entire year. So that's a yearly of all the people, all the cars, all the emissions in an entire year is still less than what Rosebank will produce.
But don't worry, the government says we can offset that, so it's all fine.
Yes.
Potentially, maybe we should do a whole, maybe we should do a podcast one day on offsetting and why it's a bit of a double-edged sword, just so if for listeners who might think that offsetting is a really good way of dealing with things, maybe we can potentially delve into that a little bit more. Is there anything else you would like to say about your news?
I think final point I'd like to say on Rosebank is, I guess, kind of similar point to that we've made about palm oil in the past. I don't know if this has been something that we've touched on Zoology Ramblings or on Biome, but this idea is that you can't just go cold turkey and stop in 24 hours and suddenly you fix the problem, you stop fossil fuels and you move on. In an ideal world, yes, that's what we could do. But it takes a lot of years to transition to more sustainable, renewable energy sources. And now is the time, well, we should have been doing this decades ago, but now is the time where they should be making that transition as smooth as possible and investing things into renewable energies, things like nuclear fusion and other energies like that, which could tip over so that we can provide the energy that we need at the scale that we need it from non-fossil fuel sources. And that takes time. I think people don't realise it's like, well, we can't just stop overnight. But you also can't just go and open the largest undeveloped oil fields in the UK. That's not how you go about that.
Well, perhaps because that was, I think, some UK bad news. Would we like some UK good news now? And I know this will be very close to mine and your heart.
Do we have UK good news?
We do have UK good news. Yeah. So a few. Well, I think it was last week I saw this. The first wild beaver was born in London for the first time in 400 years.
I take that back. I saw that and that made me very much smile. That is brilliant.
In Enfield, of all places. But yeah, they've got a little rewilding project on the Thames in Enfield. When I was reading about this, I learned something new about beavers. And I thought we knew quite a lot about beavers. And I wonder
if
you know this.
A new beaver fact? What is this
A new
madness?
Beaver fact. I know. So, did you know that the beaver has a different perception of time to humans?
No, and how the hell did they test that?
I actually don't know how they tested it, but I know how they sort of clocked it. No pun intended.
Ha!
So what I mean by it's got a different perception of time is that because they live in lodges, which are dark, they've got a different circadian rhythm to people, to us, you know, diurnal, terrestrial animals. So a beaver's day lasts from anywhere between 26 and 29 hours.
I don't know if I can get my head around that, but that is really, really cool. And
isn't that cool?
I had no idea that they had a different circadian rhythm.
The days of the beaver are longer than the days of man. well, human, I suppose. And I guess that's how they get so much done, building all those dams. Although, you know, I walked past a big dam the other day and I looked at it and I saw all that concrete and I thought, I don't think the beavers are building these.
I think you might be right.
Anyway, sorry.
I'm still on my beaver tangent, you'll be happy to know.
Oh, yes.
So one of the wildlife champions actually is working on a project to celebrate and welcome beavers back to the River Avon because they're now living there. And so it's this whole art and poetry project to celebrate them being there. And so I immediately replied, I'm like, yes, I can help in whatever ways you need. I love beavers. And so I've spent...
Brilliant. Brilliant.
I've been sending over some good beaver book recommendations, which have partly come out from stuff we've already done, nice. But also my colleagues. So yeah, forever on the beaver train.
Very nice. And I thought one last little bit to maybe round this podcast off, just because I know it'll be relevant for both of us as well. The 2022 CASA Elephant Survey results are in, so the results from last year. So for those who don't know, CASA, K-A-Z-A, is the Kavango Zambezi Transfrontier Conservation Area. Huge, great big transfrontier park, including the Okavango Delta, Chobe, in Botswana, the Kapruvi Strip in Namibia, Kafue in Zambia, Wangi in Zimbabwe, huge, great big area. And they have just published the results of their elephant survey. So the last time the population was surveyed in 2014 to 2015, there were 216,970 elephants. So this is the largest continuous population of elephants in the world. And now, in 2022, it is 227,900
Yay!
Elephants. Yay! So the elephants have increased. And they actually think it probably means the population is stable.
That's still great, though. Now...
Yeah. Although, so every country in CASA, Angola, Botswana, Namibia, Zambia, Zimbabwe, every country has increased its elephant numbers apart from Zambia.
Oh, that's upsetting.
Zambia, which is a shame. Yeah, yeah, they think it's probably a splurge in poaching. So that's unfortunate. But the population as a whole, stable and increasing.
That's really good. I think it's always easy to get swamped down with biodiversity losses. So it's always nice to hear when things are doing well, or like the beaver, first one being born in 400 years in London. Yeah. That is so, so exciting.
So that is the end of my good news, and I reckon we've probably waffled on for a while. Do you have anything else to say, or shall we let the readers? No, not the readers. Let the listeners get to their beds or whatever they do. I don't know where people listen to these things. I just waffle.
I think one final thing I want to say, something to look out for, sorry to overwhelm you with podcasts, because we have this one, the Biome Podcast, and now I'm going to tell you another one. So I'm hoping to start a podcast for the Wildlife Champions that I'm working with, which will be documenting their local community projects and kind of a bit of a on-location podcast. So going out into their community spaces and hearing what it is they want to do, how they want to achieve it, and how they're inspiring the community. So... if you'd be interested in, you know, local Avon community news, I'll let you know where that podcast will be to check it out. But it's really inspiring seeing what people are doing at a local scale. So that's why I want to promote that. But yes, that's the end of my little news.
And also, a lot of the time, if you do feel overwhelmed with the global tragedy that we're facing, the local scale is where a lot of the little good news snippets come from. And it's really nice to kind of top yourself up on that. So thank you very much for listening, everyone. As usual, you can find us on Instagram. Emma is Emma Hodson Wildlife, and I am Roby Watkinson Wildlife. And you can also find us on The Biome Project, if you just search The Biome Project on Instagram and on YouTube. So thank you so much for listening, everyone, and we will bid you adieu and see you next time. Bye.
Thank you. See you next time.